is going on.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another edition of Warrior Connection. Well, it's a bright, sunny day here in Illinois. We're pre-recording on Wednesday. Obviously, Veterans Day is coming up. We'll air on Sunday, and then Veterans Day is coming up real fast. So I thought we would do something a little special today. Denise Nichols is with me, and we're going to our guest today is Colonel Tom Yancey. He's a retired professor from the University of Illinois, and he was a World War II veteran on B-24s. Tom, welcome to Warrior Connection.
Thank you.
Well, how are you today? It's a nice sunny day, and our elections are over, aren't they?
They are over, and I'm very glad of that. I don't have to listen to all those blurbs, all of which were negative, and I don't know that I'm terribly happy with how the thing came out, but that's another matter.
Yeah, I mean, this has got to be a different change. Before you retired, being as though you're an expert in economics and all this stuff, didn't you get involved in the elections where people asked for your opinions and things?
Oh, no, I don't remember anybody asking me that.
Well, today we're going to have some fun. We're going to talk about Air Force operations through multiple generations, but we want them on a primary focus on is World War II. I mean, it's real unique. You and I have known each other about 30 years, and it's been my pleasure to be around you and everything else, but you were in World War II on B-24s, correct, sir?
That was right, yes. We were the active duty part of, or the combat duty part, I guess, is a better way to put it, was in Italy with the 15th Air Force, the 98th Bomb Group, and we were, I was a lead bombardier, and we were flying missions all over northern Italy, Yugoslavia, Hungary, Austria, southern Germany, bombing marshalling yards and airfields and oil refineries and that kind of thing. So, and I was there near the end of the war when the excitement in some ways was pretty well over, although the Germans still had a lot of flak they could throw up.
Yeah, that's a big difference. I mean, you and I have talked about it, Denise and I have talked about it. I was on B-52s during the Vietnam War where I was a bomb nav hard hat repairing like a super flight engineer, and we actually flew some of the bombing missions and put the bomb in the bucket, as we called it at that time. But from a B-24 to a B-52, that's an incredible change. Denise, what aircraft did you fly in?
Oh, well, mainly C-130s, and then was tri-qualified on the C-9 and the 141, so all about aerovac and missions to, you know, get our injured out of the theater and get them to further care.
So you also, Denise, you also came in at the Vietnam War, correct? But you were stationed stateside?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yes, I was. I came in during the Vietnam era, had a brother serving during Vietnam over in Tonsonute with the Air Force. I had my other brother, Marine, who the one brother pulled the family namesake and kept the Marine out of Vietnam.
Hey, Tom, when were you born?
1922.
Holy
In fact,
cow.
I've got a birthday coming up this month.
Really? You got a birthday?
Well, the 18th is the birthday, yes.
Well, happy birthday, Tom.
Oh,
happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, Tom Yancey. Happy birthday to you. First time you ever had a birthday song on national radio,
that,
huh?
That is correct.
Wow, 1922. Holy cow. So you were just a young puppy also when you got, did you enlist or get drafted for the Army Air Corps?
Yes, I was drafted. I tried to enlist, and they told me I had high blood pressure and rejected me, and they drafted me about a month later, and I didn't have high blood pressure anymore.
Surprise, surprise, surprise.
Yes. So
I mean, Denise,
I ended up
at the time, Vietnam War, and then we learned Desert Storm, they were just about taking anybody they could, didn't they?
Oh, yes. And so at the time I went in, it was the Army Air Corps. And that particular day, I guess, they decided they would put everybody that came in the Army Air Corps. And we were sent to Mamma Beach, which wasn't a bad place to go. and we used the hotels that were down there to live in. They built mess halls on vacant lots around there, and we used the golf course for a drill field. And when I got through the basic training part of that, they put me on KP because I was too big to be a gunner, and they couldn't think of anything else really to do. And after about a week or two on KP every day, I decided there had to be something better, and I saw this advertisement about becoming an aviation cadet. So I went over and took the tests and made that, and that got me started on it.
So did you go in? Did you go in out of college, or had you completed some college when World War II started, well, or were you just get drafted in as enlisted and then change to officer?
No, no. When I graduated from high school in 1940, I couldn't afford to go to college, and I couldn't find a fellowship that was good enough to pay all the way. And I went to a place called Chillicothe Business College. And at Chillicothe, Missouri. And at that time, it was in enrollment, it was bigger than the University of Missouri. They had about 3,400 students there. And most of them were women, but they also taught accounting and business law and other things. So I went there, and when I finished there, which I spent 2 years doing it, with time off to do work on the farm in between, and got a job with Electromotive Corporation in Chicago building. I was in the purchasing department. We were building locomotives for the railroads, and it was from there that I got drafted into the Air Force or Army Air Corps.
Boy, that was a big difference. So from a farm boy to an Army Air Corps in the B-24s.
Yes, it was.
Where did you, once you got into flight training, where did you progress in small aircraft and then up into a B-24, or how did all that happen?
Well, the way they were doing it at that time, when I first went in, they just had us stockpiled there in Miami Beach, and we spent our time trying to drill more sharply than anybody else. We marched everywhere. And they, after a week or so of that, they sent us off to college. I went to Winthrop College for Women, which had no women, by the way, at Rock Hill, South Carolina. And they made up a program for us. We got some choice in it, but it was mathematics and physics and things of that kind. And we were supposed to get flight training there at the end, solo in a Piper Cub. But unfortunately, somebody in the class ahead of me a week or two got sick, and I got drafted to replace him. And so instead of being able to solo in a Piper Cub, I got a free ride in one for about an hour.
Was that the first time you'd ever been in an airplane?
That was the first time I was ever in an airplane, yes. And then we were sent from there to classification in Nashville, Tennessee, and again tested to decide what position we would take. And they called me back and said, "You did very well on the test. You may have your choice. You may be a pilot, a bombardier, or a navigator." And remembering that time on KP, which I wanted to get away from, I said, I'll be a bombardier because that's the shortest term to completion and getting a commission. So that's how I got to be a bombardier. And then from there, they sent us to pre-flight at Santa Ana, California, for about 8 weeks, as I recall. And from that, we went to gunnery school in Las Vegas. That was about another 6 weeks, I guess. And then we went from there to bombardier training, which in my case was Carlsbad, New Mexico. And I don't remember just how long that was, but I think it must have been somewhere around 4 months. And Then after that was finished, we ended up in Tucson, where we were assigned to crews, and ended up at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base in Tucson with a crew. And after we finished, they decided that, you know, we don't need a bombardier on every plane. We're flying in formation. We just need a lead bombardier and a deputy lead if the lead gets knocked out. And everybody else in the formation will just toggle their bombs when they see a flare go off on the lead plane. And so they pulled me off of that crew and sent them on over and put me on another crew, which did go over. The first crew got shot down on their first mission, which was pretty exciting for them. I've met with them one time, oh, several times since, I guess. They all got back all right from that. But they spent, I guess, about 8 or 9 months in a prisoner of war camp in Germany. So then I went over with the second crew and got pulled off of that to be a lead bombardier. And so I never flew with the same people twice, really. And
now that was some kind of different thing.
We would get briefed, and off we would go.
When we look at the historical notes of B-24, the Liberator, I mean, that was a long-range bomber at that time in World War II.
Yeah.
And it had a range of about 3,000 miles.
Oh, yeah, it would.
About,
a mission was anywhere from 8 to 10 hours long, and we were flying about close around 230 miles an hour or so. And I guess the 17 was the one that got all the publicity. The 24 was about 7 feet longer on the wingspan, but would carry twice as many bombs in weight as a 17 would. And there were 10 people in the crew, pilot, co-pilot, navigator, and bombardier. And then there were six people to man the turret on the front, the turret on the top, the ball turret on the bottom, the tail turret, and then two at waist guns. And that was the way the crew was made up. And you took off, and at the time I got there, which was at the end of 1944 and beginning of 45, not too much long before the war ended, the fighters were pretty well, they had a few jets that would make a pass at you occasionally, but the fighters had been pretty much taken out. Our fighter group had pretty well wiped the whole German fighter squadrons out at that point, but they had a lot of flak they could throw up. But you would go along looking for planes, and you'd spot something and keep your eye on it carefully for a while to see if it developed into a plane, and then you'd wipe the spot off the window and look somewhere else. So we didn't have too much in the way of squabbles with fighters.
Now, obviously, you know, coming out of Italy, the famed Red Tails were the fighter support in that area. Did you ever get the opportunity to fly with those or meet any of them?
In Italy, we were stationed, the 98th Bomb Group was stationed at Lecce, which is right down in the middle of the boot heel. It was the base we had over the farthest south. And I remember one time one of them landed at our field. We had what was left of the Italian Air Force there on the field, too. They changed sides, and they were flying those old Mackies, and they couldn't get any parts or anything, so if one had trouble, they had to cannibalize another one to get that one to go. I remember some Italian that worked there on the base, we used them to do a lot of the groundwork for cleaning the place up and so forth. And he made the comment about Italian planes go, American planes go,
I guess that's a part of history I'd never heard before, that the Italians actually switched sides at the end of 44.
They used to fly missions. They flew those Mackies. I never knew what they did, but they went over somewhere toward Yugoslavia, apparently. And they didn't carry bombs, so I have no idea what they thought they were doing. We sort of ignored them.
At that time, the B-24, I mean, that was kind of the cream of the crop with the airplanes, was it? I mean, there were more B-24s built than any other aircraft during World War II.
There were about
bombers.
That's right. There were more.
The payload was huge in comparison to a B-17, huh?
It was. About twice, as I remember it. And let's see, what was I going to say before I lost my train of thought? Who knows?
Yeah, on a B-52, when we flew those, we had 70,000 pounds of bombs, and when we look at the B-24 stats, they're looking at about 10,000 pounds.
Yeah, I think
it's incredible size and payload differences just in the one generation.
That's right. Well, there was a 29 in between.
Mm-hmm.
When we left Italy to come back to the States, in fact, Roosevelt died while we were on a ship coming back. That would have been in April. And we were supposed to switch to B-29s and go to Japan and help out on that operation. But the Air Force doesn't move too fast, so we sat on an air base up in Nebraska for a while, and they dropped the A-bomb before we got much of anything squared away. And then, of course, the war was over pretty quick after that. So we never really made the transition to 29s.
So what did that feel like? I mean, here you've been flying bombing missions. You're a young puppy, wet behind the ears. You've traveled all over the world now, coming off of a farm in Missouri. What were your thoughts and ideas about going to war? I don't think that changes much through generations, but it had to be really strange.
Well, everybody, you know, World War II, everybody that wasn't in a very crucial position or who couldn't pass the physical ended up in the military. And so you just expected to go, and I don't know that I gave it much thought. To the extent I thought about it, I thought about how I could improve my position from being on KP to something better.
Now, my dad was in the Navy and during World War II. And Denise, was your father in World War II?
No.
Denise?
The answer was no. I wanted to talk about the change in how we, from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Desert Storm, to, you know, Iraq, and the change in using the Air Force. You know, I think World War II, we had very effective joint command and mission, you know, guided everything. Not sure about Korea or Vietnam, but Desert Storm, you know, kind of really put out the Air Force out in front to really changed the course of the war and speed it up. And it seems like we've lost some of the lessons that we've learned in empowering the Air Force and Joint Force.
Yeah, when you were dropping bombs out of B-24s, I mean, how many aircraft would fly in a mission? I mean, during the B-52s in the Vietnam War, we had three B-52s in a cell, so we'd have three aircraft per bombing mission. How many aircraft were flying in a mission at that time, or did they just take everybody off and go flying?
Well, they flew in groups of seven planes. It was a diamond-shaped pattern, lead plane, one on off each wing, and then one behind and slightly below the lead plane. And then off the second plane, deputy lead, they had another one on each wing and the seventh plane flying back, behind, so it made a diamond pattern. And then that would be a typical squadron, and you'd have four squadrons on a base, so you'd have 28 planes out of that, and then you would have other bases. So when we went into a target, good Lord, there were literally hundreds of planes.
Wow. And, what did you run into? Obviously, you said that the fighter aircraft, German fighter aircraft, were pretty much out of the picture by the time you got there. But what kind of missions did you fly on, or what kind of targets did they send you at?
Oh, they would send us the typical target was we'd get airfields to keep the German Air Force out of it, and bomb them so that the runways weren't usable, et cetera. And then we would bomb marshaling yards to knock out trains that were assembled and knock out whatever they were carrying. And then we would bomb oil refineries to deny them that. We'd bomb some factories. And then from time to time, they would pick things like bridges and so forth and send a small group of planes there. It was pretty much that pattern all over. And we would bomb in northern Italy. They were still fighting there. And Austria, Vienna would catch quite a lot, and other places. I remember after the war, Catherine and I were riding around Europe just on a train, and we decided to stop at this little town of Klagenfurt. And I said, I bombed Klagenfurt. So we got off the train, and there was not much of anything going on. We walked around town, stayed overnight, that evening we went to a walking, and as we passed a theater, there were people getting out of fancy cars going in, and they hauled Catherine and I in and plopped us down in about the third row, and we had no idea what was going on. And after a little bit, the program started, and this fellow came on and said, we're here today to celebrate the end of the American occupation of Austria. And I thought, oh, my, we're back. So they put on quite a show. There was an opera group in town, and they sang and so forth. It was very pleasant, but I was surprised they parked us up in the front as though we were very special guests.
Well, that's kind of different. So World War II ended, and you've had all these missions. Here you're a young puppy. You've had a whole bunch of missions on B-24s, been places all over, seen things that nobody your age would ever dream of. And unfortunately, the generations upon generations keep seeing it. What, you came back then here to the University of Illinois, didn't you?
Yeah, I came back, and the GI Bill had been passed, and so I wanted to take advantage of that. And so I decided to go to the University of Missouri. It was kind of as long as you stayed in the state of Missouri, it was probably the best school around. And so I went down there in got out in about October, and the next semester didn't start until January. So I went down there and enrolled, and since I had an accounting background from the business school, I thought I'll just go into accounting, which I did. And you know, they made that GI program, they counted the days you were in combat, all of them, or days you were in the military, all of them, but they only counted against it when you were using it up in school for the days you went to school. So if you went to school only 3 days a week, they only counted 3 days off of the amount of time you had put in the military. And so I went through and they also speeded things up. They let us take proficiency tests and pass some courses without taking them. And then they ran the summer term was 12 weeks long then instead of the usual 8 like they had later. so you could go to school more days a year. So I finished a four-year degree in 2 years in a semester.
Wow, that's moving fast.
It really went right along. And then I got a master's degree there, also in accounting, and took a job up at Knox College in Galesburg, Illinois, for a couple of years. And then I came down at the University of Missouri, enrolled, finished the PhD, and never left.
Well, and when you got to the U of I, and I've seen the, you know, obviously at your house, we've seen the photos and the video, and WIL has done a special on that. Didn't you live in some kind of old war barracks to the west
yes.
side of what's
that's
the football stadium
they,
at the U of I when you first came here?
Oh, yeah. They had barracks. There were a few two-story ones around, which they put single men in. But right west of the stadium, there was a big grassy area there on the south side of, what is that? That's not First Street, is it?
Yeah, it'd be on the west side of First Street.
Yeah. And they had built these one-story barracks with three apartments in effect in each barracks. They had the married people in there. Most of them were married with children. And then they had some trailers a little further north. I guess it had people that were just man and wife. And then way over on the corner of Lincoln and what would it be? I guess the equivalent of Florida, they had more barracks built. Some of those were two-story jobs. So they had a lot of veterans that they had in the buildings, and some faculty members would end up in them for a short while before they could find a place to live because they were expanding the faculty rapidly to take care of all the veterans, et cetera.
So at the end of World War II, I mean, with the GI Bill, I mean, like I came back from Vietnam and went to college right away, and Denise, you went and did your master's in that. I mean, what was it like? I mean, the colleges had to be overwhelmed with this new capability, the GI Bill, and all these guys coming back to school. It had to be a very interesting time.
Oh, it was. You had a lot of veterans, and they were all pretty serious students. So they didn't put up with a lot of the nonsense and foolishness that people used to as regular freshmen from right out of high school. They just expanded the size of classes enormously in some cases. So you'd have some fellow teaching a beginning course, and he would have 75 or 100 people in the class and then have teaching assistants to help him out.
That's a big difference because I know when I ended up as a professor here in the end of the 90s, I had maybe 10, 15, 20 in my grad school classes, and I'd have maybe 30 in my undergrad classes, but that would be the top end.
Yeah. Yeah, this was right after the war, and they just didn't have enough faculty to cover it. And so they would just expand the size of the class, put them in a big auditorium, and conduct it that way.
Now, when did you and Catherine get married, after World War II or during World War II?
Oh, after. I didn't meet her until I was at the University of Missouri. There are three colleges in Columbia, Missouri. It was then Christian College, which was all women, Stevens College, which was all women, and the University of Missouri. So since there were three colleges, we called it the Athens of the Midwest. And she went to Christian College. It's now called Columbia College. And I met her there, and we got married in 1948, which was the year she graduated and the year I graduated.
That's pretty neat. Yeah, Denise, you went to Desert Storm, and you came back. You had, what, a four-year-old at that time or three-year-old?
Yeah, she turned four. So but I really want to go back and get his perspective on how we've utilized the Air Force since World War II through to the current time and some of his thoughts as far as utilizing the Air Force and how it's changed.
Well, you know, I think I don't have any complaint with the way they've developed it. I think it's marvelous that they've got these drones now, and you can send them, and they can, they've got the equipment, they can hit targets very nicely, and you shoot one down, nobody goes down with it. That's a big improvement over the old days. But as time went on, they just improved the speed and distance planes could fly and the amount they could carry. And I don't know that I see anything that I would have done differently.
You know, the B-52 carried 70,000 pounds of explosives, and obviously incredible amounts, and now missiles and nuclear missiles and everything. But the bombing system we had on the B-52 was an ASQ-48. That was early computers and avionics stuff. So that was quite a contrast. We did have one periscope where, you know, you could put the crosshairs on. Mm-hmm. On a B-24, did you have what was called a Norden bombsight or something?
That's right. We had the Norden bombsight, and they were all very proud of it. It was a pretty good instrument, actually. It sat on top of an autopilot so that when you started the bomb run, all the pilot controlled was the airspeed, and which he tried to hold steady. And the autopilot took over at that point, and so the bombardier was really flying the plane by putting the crosshairs on the target. And then you had a couple of little wheels you turned to adjust it to keep the two crosshairs on the target, one for the horizontal, one for the vertical. And they always told you when you're using one that you don't turn those wheels, you just breathe on them. And
same as the B-52. I mean, very little difference. I mean, I think one of the most unique things had is we were flying up at 30,000 and 40,000 and 50,000 feet.
That's a lot higher. We usually flew somewhere 22,000. The 17s flew about 30,000. We could do a pretty good job of hitting a target. You lock those crosshairs on it. If you talk about a practice range where you could drop the bomb and see where it hit, it wasn't uncommon to be able to fly and drop bombs and have them hit within 25 or 30 feet of the bullseye, the center of the target.
I mean, that's learning a lot of, you know, physics and mechanics and everything else, but then the equipment could do it.
Yeah.
But when you were learning, doing through the bombed air course, this was out of Las Vegas then on what's known as Nellis?
No, it was at Carlsbad, and it's one of the fields they closed completely. It may be a city airport now, I don't know, but it's no longer an Air Force unit.
Did you have many air crews that got shot down when you got over there and started flying, or was it getting safe in the air at that time?
We didn't lose very many. No, we had a few that got shot down. Others that got shot up rather thoroughly, and the plane got back all right, or maybe they abandoned it in the Adriatic on the way back. But we lost very few crews that way.
So that's very different. I mean, on the B-24, I mean, the difference between, when I read about it, again, and you were right there, the difference between a B-17, a B-24, B-25, and then the B-29 are just like night and day, aren't they?
Well, yes. The 25 was just a much smaller aircraft, two engine instead of four, and it didn't carry as big a bomb load or has as big a range. It was famous for the famous Tokyo raid and on Japan right after the war, and I saw them occasionally, but I don't know where they were really stationed and used. In Italy, we had almost entirely nothing but the 24s. The 17s were in England, and they were there earlier in the 8th Air Force than that we. We had to wait until we took Italy, or part of it, before we could get the 24s in down there. So the 17s did the early part of the bombing and got all the great publicity. And they were pretty rugged in terms of being able to take a lot of punishment before they came out of the sky. I don't know that they were any better at it than a 24, but they had a reputation of being rather invincible that way.
Now, when you went over there, did you fly in a bombardier to get over to Italy, or did you go on a ship, or how did you get there from the United States?
No, we flew over. They gave us when we left Davis Mountain, we went to Topeka, Kansas, and picked up a brand new B-24. I've forgotten the name of that base. And then we flew from there to a base in Massachusetts, and then from there to down to the Bahamas, and then across to the Azores, and then North Africa, and then into Italy.
Wow. I know when I went over to Desert Storm, we took off in a 141. We left up in Wisconsin, then we flew to Massachusetts, again, what's known as Westover Air Force Base. Then we went over and flew into Spain, and from Spain, then we landed in Riyadh. Denise, when you landed in the middle of a combat operation when you went into Riyadh during Desert Storm, didn't you?
Yeah, that was the actual... We were on the East Coast when the president spoke, and right after that, we were on the plane headed over, and we went from Dover to Germany, had a stop in Germany, and then went right into Riyadh, and we landed there when the first Scuds were hitting. That was our welcome. You're under Scud alert and Scud attack. All the aeromeds were coming in, you know, a little bit late because they had to get all the other forces in, and then aeromeds, you know, came in to get set up. So there was a lot of movement going on from Riyadh up to KKMC and then forward. Following the Army as they moved forward.
Now, during Desert Storm, Denise, your responsibility, you were up at Log Base Charlie putting up for the Air Force medevac, bringing the severely wounded out from right on the combat line to the rear hospitals in Germany, correct?
Well, actually, they all came into, from the forward areas, they all came into either KKMC or King Fahd, and that's when they switched from, you know, tactical to... strategic to 141s to get them over to Europe. So those were kind of hub operations for the Air Force, was back to King Fahd or KKMC, and then they were sorted out and put on 141s to go to Europe. So that's how it operated. You know, we've got someone here with so much history from World War II all the way forward. And having just gone through an election, really, I always like to talk to my World War II vets and get their perspective on how our country's doing. You know, it's a lot of history that you carry with you, and, you know, some words of wisdom to carry forward.
Senility is another thing that comes with age.
Well, Tom, when you came back, you got your PhD at the University of Illinois. Obviously, you got married and stayed there and became a professor. And you were, what did you teach there, sir?
I was teaching in the econ department, and within that, I taught statistics and mathematical economics and econometrics. I always said if you couldn't write it in an equation, I couldn't understand it. So they were not the most popular courses in the world, but... particularly statistics, they all had to take it. And and our classes were fairly good size. We'd have as many as 50 or 60 in the class.
Now, did you you stay in the reserves then? After
I stayed
World War
in the reserve, yes, which I think was a very good move because at this point, because I stayed in, I collect retirement pay, and I have... access to and use TRICARE for life and for medical activity, and it pays all the bills. And that part has worked out very well.
You know, both Denise and I, as you know, retired as majors. You retired as lieutenant colonel, sir?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, I know in all the years when you and I first met, about 30 years ago, but you stayed very active because at the University of Illinois you had the armory, and ROTC was literally across the street from your office, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, it was. It was right down the street. And, yes, we used to meet, well, we met a number of different places in the reserves. I can't remember how many, maybe it was twice a month, I'm not quite sure. Then you took a two-week tour during, in my case, in the summer, because that was when university wasn't in session, and you had to accumulate, as I recall, 60 points a year, and you got, in effect, a point for every day that you put in either in the active duty tour or the monthly meetings, and you could also take correspondence courses and pick up points that way.
How many years did you spend in the military? Obviously, you went in originally, what, 1943 or 1944?
I went in, right at the end of 43, and, well, they finally threw me out at age 60, so which I hit at 1982.
Yeah, because I know I'd already met you by that time. We were having a lot of fun, and one thing, the neat thing, again, I think you've had a lot of joy at is being able to honor all the University of Illinois ROTC cadets over the years, haven't you, sir?
Oh, yes, because I joined the Reserve Officers Association and the Military Officers Association, and we used to conduct, there was a day in the spring at graduation when they got all the cadets together and midshipmen, et cetera, and they would give them their commissions, and they always had us handing out medals to people for the students for their activities that they had done, and that is still going on.
What have you seen over all the years from, you know, in the military so long and being at the university where you stay young forever for so long and you're still a young puppy?
Oh, yes.
At least when we get together, you're running around like a young puppy. What have you seen as the kids, as how have they changed or everything as far as, you know, patriotism and involvement and everything else? What has happened and changed from World War II to the present?
Well, I guess I don't know that much that I've observed that was different. My guess is that there are fewer people now who are taking ROTC. I don't think it's required. Back earlier, I think people were anxious to take it and end up with a commission. I have five children, and they've gone the military route. So out of the five children, I've got, counting spouses, I've got a brigadier general, a full colonel, and two lieutenant colonels.
That's an incredible accomplishment. I know I remember when your son made general, we were celebrating. You were so happy. You and Catherine were in joy.
Oh, yes.
That is something else. I mean, to come through World War II and do all this stuff and raise your kids at the university, for them to go on to such incredible careers, especially in the military.
Yeah, they all just seem to enjoy it, and that came off fairly well.
Now, Denise, your husband was in the Air Force also, correct?
Correct.
He retired as a colonel?
Lieutenant Colonel, and he was the pilot, 130s, and so that's how we met.
I mean, there's just so much in all the changes and everything. I mean, what do you think the future holds? We just had an election and everything, and the outcomes. Obviously, the Republicans have grabbed both the House and the Senate now for the first time in many years, and the state of Illinois has had massive changes here as far as the governor and everything else and legislators. And, I don't know, Colorado. Denise, what happened in Colorado?
Well, we lost our senior senator. That's one thing. was tight races all the way around. We did retain our Democratic governor, but we lost control of one of the houses of the state house. And obviously, you know, everybody took a beating. You know, the Republican swing that happened last night was amazing to watch. And the thing that concerns me is, you know, we need to move forward. I think people were fed up with the do-nothing Congress. I mean, what we've had in the last session is the lowest activity on getting bills through. And, you know, I said last night when it was all over and done that I think I could see it coming, knowing the divisions and everything that was happening. And I've heard referrals. I was trying to listen to it before we came on to do our interview today. Heard referrals that some of this is reminiscence of when Eisenhower was around. You know, it's a very historical sweep that happened across the nation. And, you know, I have to, I keep looking at Kansas and kind of was kind of unbelievable what happened there because their Republican governor, that state's heavily in debt now where it wasn't before. And, of course, it's a Republican state and has been for years and years. But I don't know what to think. We have to, you know, just see as they move forward if there's more of a agreement to get back to work on the Hill and, you know, work each side and have something productive come out for the people. So that's why I asked, you know, for some historical viewpoint from our person we're interviewing today. He's seen a lot of history and a lot of changes through his years, you know, through elections and everything. And that's kind of what I was hoping to achieve is some reflections on history here.
Well, you know, the Roosevelt administration was confronted with a much deeper recession than we've had in this round. And all those programs that created, like the CCC, that moved out WPA, and did a lot of work on patching the roads up and fixing parks and that kind of thing. And I would think we could solve part of our unemployment problem if we would resort to strategies like that again.
You know what? That's interesting because I've been thinking that for quite a while with our need to revamp our roads and renew them. That why that wasn't an effort that was considered.
Apparently, the debt scares everybody so badly that they just aren't willing to commit the resources to do some of these things that I think would have probably in the end reduced the debt by the time the people got busy and spent the money that they were making and. We could improve the schools and get people educated better to take jobs. There are jobs around now, but apparently there are a lot of people that aren't trained to step in and take them.
Right.
I think one of the things that's real unique,
I mean,
and I've got all of us.
Roads and bridges that were built so many years ago that, you know, we haven't paid attention to, you know, putting our effort there, and that is a expenditure that returns so much. I mean, you know, World War II vets showed us the way on that.
Yes. Yes, you're quite right. Well, here in Champaign, Urbana, you go anywhere and you're quite aware that the streets need a great deal of work. And they don't get to it too quick.
That's a significant problem. I think with all three of us, I mean, Tom, you were at the World War II where you took advantage of the brand-new GI Bill, and Denise and I took advantage of it from Vietnam and Desert Storm. I mean, one thing that you learn as a professor, anybody can do pretty much anything they decide to do if they put in the effort and make the commitment, can't they?
I think you're quite right, and that holds just not for people in this country. I was in a program for about 15 years that the Ford Foundation ran. It was a summer program. It was run at the University of Colorado. and Boulder, and it was for foreign students who were coming to this country for graduate training. They had been accepted for graduate training at some university in the States, and that expansion of students came from Africa, North and South of the Sahara, across the Middle East, India, Pakistan, and Afghanistan and so forth, Nepal, on into what had been French Indochina, all that region, Japan, some Chinese, Indonesians, and a lot of South Americans and Mexicans. And from that, the students would come, and we would test them very thoroughly in English and in economics, and then we would make up a program for them to try to make their first semester as successful as possible. Now, these were people that turned out to be very important in their countries. For example, the current president of Liberia, Ellen Sirleaf Johnson, was a student in that program. I used to have lunch with her several times a week while she was in the program, and she went on to become president of the country. And
it must feel pretty good to have that kind of success in one of your students.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, they all went back home. They were required to do that. They all went back home and were very important people, some in government, some in schools, and that kind of thing. But what you discover very quickly is that regardless of where they came from, race, that kind of thing, they're all about equally bright and able to work. It isn't something that's confined. It depends heavily on their motivation and the amount of education and so forth they can get.
Yeah, so, our education system has trained so many foreign students. And, you know, they went back to their countries and gave back to their countries. And we tend to forget that.
Yes.
Do you think students today have the same dedication that they did? I know from when I got out of Vietnam and came back, I mean, got out on Tuesday and started college on Friday, and we had to, you know, make the commitment to study and get through in 4 years. Students today are taking 4 or 5 years, maybe 6 years to get through their undergraduate program. Is it that the college has changed so much and make it more difficult, or is it just that they tried to do more than they can get done in a given period of time?
You know, I think a lot of it would have to do with their trying to meet the financial obligations that come with it. These students now borrow a lot of money, leave school owing a lot of money, and I'm sure they try their very best to make some money while they're there. And by doing it, I think they've slowed down their ability to get through. So
I agree with you. I think a lot of it's the economics and students trying to work and not being full-time students, but, you know, trying to carry
yes.
a part-time job and pay some of their bills as they're going through. That's what I've seen. My daughter, you know, has gone through in the last. She, you know, went through, took a little longer getting through her bachelor's program because she was working, although she took full loads, but, you know, took her a little longer and got out and worked a couple of years before going back, you know, for advanced degrees type thing. And I think we see a lot of that, and I think that is a problem for our country.
I think so, too.
You know, I have to... I'm going to recognize somebody here. I don't know how you all feel, but I think Senator Elizabeth Warren, she's taking up the issue for that huge loan debt that the students are carrying. And I think that's one of the things that this coming in Congress needs to pay attention to, because if we do not help our students, and it just creates a problem long term down the road for our young people that are getting educated.
I think that's right. I think we're having fewer people that go, say, in school, whether it's trade school or something else, as long as they should, to be able to get to qualify for jobs that Now they can't quite yet, but which would be much more satisfactory for them if they could get a higher income level.
And you
they
know,
have one of the big discussion, obviously,
II,
was on the ballot referendum here is increasing the minimum wage to $10 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of those jobs where the minimum wage are basically unskilled labor, wouldn't it be better if these individuals or the commitment would made to get them the better education, to get them more qualified for all these trade jobs that are going unfulfilled here?
Well, yes, it would be nice to get them trained to take advantage of that.
I see a lot of students going through for degrees that will not earn them a lot of money and is not looking forward to the technology that we have nowadays. So I think that's one of the big issues that this country needs to look at historically. I mean, World War II vets that went back to school that created a lot of the industries that we have today. You know, learning the lessons from that history of how valuable our education system is, and not to weaken it, but to make it stronger.
I agree with you.
And I
Tom,
think
what, we just got a few minutes left here. Tom, what, I mean, you've lived through an incredible amount of history. You've been involved in everything from the military to everything to raising a family, being at the university. What kind of hopes and dreams do you have for this the future and the next generation? I mean, that's a big question, but I'm giving it wide open.
Yes. Well, of course, the when you say next generation, the next generation, in my case, was my children, and they're all retired by now.
Yeah, we're all the same age. Your son and I were both born in 49, as you
that's
and I
right.
were about.
And so we're down to the grandchildren at that point. And in my case, they've all they're either in college or they've finished college, and they chose to do things. Well, I have one son who's a chiropractor and married to a chiropractor, and or grandson, and another one who. Works in a radio station in some technical fashion that I don't understand. And then another one who teaches athletics, tennis in particular, at a junior college in California. And the next one down the line is at the University of Arizona in school, and he's doing very well. So... when I look at my own family, they all seem to be getting along all right. But I think there are a lot of people's children who aren't.
I think one was unique. Like, my kids, they were all raised at the University of Illinois, so that's all they ever knew was university life, and the same with your kids. I think there is a big difference when the children are raised at a university versus away from a university, and the influence on experiences and I mean, it's just totally different because the influences and the opportunity to see so much is so much different than the average person out there, isn't it?
Well, I think you're quite right. There's just all kinds of activities in a university town like this that if you live in a town that doesn't have a university like that, you just don't have any exposure to.
Now, Denise, your daughter is real successful now. She's finishing up law school, correct?
Yeah, but I think we've overproduced lawyers. I've got a real concern there. But that was what she fell in love with, is law. And, you know, like I said, I think that we have to look at, you know, how many are we producing on the different fields and where the needs are. And I don't think that... guidance for the young people in looking at other fields is out there. You know, I think that we need to do more, you know, educating of our youth of some of the things to look forward to.
Well, anything we got in about the end of the time now. We only got a couple of minutes left, I think. Denise, do you have any observations or anything of what's been happening recently in the military and the VA? I mean, obviously, they've got a new director appointed in Phoenix. they've came on back and said that obviously the report on Phoenix was altered by the VA Inspector General to meet the demands for political correctness. And how do you think this is all going to play out? You mean you're totally involved up there in Washington?
Well, I'm still withholding my judgment on the new secretary. You know, I think they had a big problem that it was going on for decades, and it's sad that it wasn't paid attention to until everything had to just, you know, come out as a scandal, which, you know, should have been dealt with all along the way. So, you know, I think it was a system that needed looking at, and I hope that we look at the value of the VA, improve it, strengthen it. I hope that they don't tear it down and go completely civilian. There are benefits to the VA, but there's a lot of problems there. And it's been left to kind of languish and not make the huge changes that needed to be made. I know the secretary's out there recruiting and going to medical schools and putting the plea out there to get, you know, the doctors involved more. And that has been needed a long time. So I'm glad he's doing that, and that has not been done for decades of a real push to get some of our best-trained doctors into the VA to provide the best care for the veterans. We have a big problem with the needs of those that have been in Iraq and Afghanistan. Not so much, you know, we've always led the way with amputations and prosthesis, and that's just amazing work they've done there. But we haven't done as much work on the psychological needs for those in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we haven't done enough with our exposures. And the history of dealing with exposures with the military veterans has been poor to non-existent. And yet we've had, you know, the vets from World War One with mustard agent, you know, World War II, the atomic vets, with all the testing that went in, they didn't get enough attention and the forward advances that were needed. To Agent Orange, we've had this issue for decades with exposures, and not only overseas in wartime, but also with our bases that were contaminated. So I think we need to really focus on what the true priorities and needs are, not let the other go downhill of the good prosthetic development and the good way of saving lives, which we've tremendously made a difference from battlefield medicine. But looking at the areas that we haven't done well with and putting the emphasis there, putting the emphasis on environmental exposures and really not treating them like psychological casualties when it's been environmental hazardous materials. I think we've done a disservice to our veterans in that area historically. And, you know, Agent Orange, basically they got presumptives for the diseases as they were diagnosed. There was no forward-looking of pushing for more medical advances of how do you deal with people that are exposed to this and what early changes can you make. So we've got a long ways to go, I guess is how I state it. And with 22 veterans at least committing suicide a day, suicide by cops, we've got a lot of work to do and a lot of education of the civilian world to be done. We've talked to many parents on our program here of trying to get help for their son or daughters coming back with psychological needs, and they don't have enough people to meet the need. So we have a problem, and it's not going to go away, and we need to pay attention to it and make changes. And I'm not seeing that as strongly as I would like to.
Well, I guess we're about at the end of our time. Tom, thank you very much. Denise, thank you. We'll continue our conversations. Remember, Veterans Day is coming up this week. Remember to help a veteran. That's what it's all about. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, and good evening.